From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, what the neuroscience of schizophrenia, autism, Alzheimer's, and lesser-known mental and cognitive conditions can tell us about the sense of self.
By examining conditions in which the self is disturbed or perturbed, you can start asking questions about how the self might be put together in the brain in the first place.
We'll talk with science journalist Anil Ananthaswamy. His new book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self, draws on case studies, including those of patients with the rare condition Cotard syndrome. The symptoms include the belief that one is dead.
This is a perception that they have, and you cannot give them evidence to the contrary and expect them to change their mind. It is a complete conviction that they don't exist.
And rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of bluesman Slim Harpo. That's on Fresh Air. Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. Here's another podcast you might want to check out, Alt Latino. It's a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. You'll hear from the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order. Alt Latino is from NPR Music. You can find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know you're alive, right? And you know that your arms are your arms and that your legs are part of your body. But people with certain rare conditions don't know these things. People with Cotard syndrome believe they are dead and don't exist. People with body integrity identity disorder usually believe that one of their limbs is alien to their body. They sometimes want that limb amputated. These rare conditions, as well as more common ones, including schizophrenia and Alzheimer's disease, distort the sense of self. Some neuroscientists are investigating what these conditions can teach us about how we form a sense of self. My guest, Anil Ananthaswamy, is a science journalist who's written a new book called The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. He's a consultant for New Scientist magazine and is guest editor of the Science Writing Program at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's won the Physics Journalism Prize from the UK Institute of Physics and the Best Investigative Journalism Award from the Association of British Science Writers. His first book, The Edge of Physics, was voted Book of the Year in 2010 by Physics World. Anil Ananthaswamy, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about what neurologists are learning about what creates the sense of self, what do we mean when we use the word self in this context?
That's a very good question, Terry, and it's a complicated one in the sense that when you ask someone, who are you, you're most likely to get a kind of a narrative answer. I am so-and-so, I'm a father, I'm a son. They are going to tell you a kind of story that they have in their heads about themselves, the story that they tell to themselves and to others. And in some sense, that's what can be called the narrative self. And that's something we're all familiar with. There are also other ways of thinking about the self. Like, for instance, you and I right now are probably sitting on our chairs and we have a sense of being a body that is in one place we can feel the sensations in our body. But what it comes down to is this sense we have of being someone or something to which things are happening. And, it's there when we wake up in the morning. It kind of disappears when we go to sleep. It reappears in our dreams. And it's also this sense we have of being an entity that spans time. So we can think back to our earliest memories. We can imagine ourselves in the future. And whatever perceptions arise when we remember or when we imagine, whatever emotions arise, they again feel like they're happening to the same person. So all of these things put together in some sense can be called our sense of self. And that's what philosophers and neurologists and neuroscientists are always wondering about. So, how does the brain create this very, very complex self?
One of the most unusual and paradoxical conditions that you write about in The Man Who Wasn't There is Cotard syndrome. And this is the belief that you're already dead. And it's just kind of impossible to fathom how somebody who is talking and telling you that they're dead cannot really think they're dead since they're existing and describing to you that they think they're dead. Like, which is something a dead person couldn't actually do. Would you describe the symptoms of this condition?
Yeah, so this Cotard syndrome was something that was first identified by a French doctor in the late 1800s. His name was Jules Cotard, and it's named after him. It's a constellation of symptoms, and like you pointed out, the most kind of characteristic symptom is the situation where people say that they don't exist. This is a perception that they have, and you cannot rationalize, you cannot really give them evidence to the contrary and expect them to change their mind. It is a complete conviction that they have that they don't exist. In some sense, you're right. It's very, very paradoxical. It poses a great philosophical challenge to people who are trying to understand what it means to say I exist or I don't exist. It also makes you wonder about all the other things that we are certain about. Like, you and I probably are very certain we exist. Well, these people are just as certain that they don't. So makes you question about perceptions that arise in the brain, and somehow, in this case, the delusion is so complete and so convincing that you really cannot shake their conviction that they're dead.
One of the patients who had this told the doctor who you were interviewing that she had no teeth and no uterus and that she's certain that she was dead. And when presented with visual proof that she had teeth, that didn't convince her. How rare is this?
The Cotard syndrome is very rare. There are just a few hundred recorded cases in the literature. So it's not that common. And it's a very extreme situation in which people are actually very, very depressed. There was a French psychiatrist I met who described the nature of depression that people with Cotards suffer from. He drew me a line diagram in which he started by pointing out that, okay, on the left side, we're, you know, there's normal, there's sad, melancholic, depressed, very depressed, and then he drew a series of dots. The scale was not linear anymore, and on the other end of that scale, he put Cotards, saying that it's really, you know, people with Cotards are so depressed. He had a way with words. He said it's like having a great black wall from here to the planet Saturn, and you can't look over it when you're in suffering from Cotards. So it's an extreme condition in that sense.
What has imaging of the brains of people who have Cotards revealed about the cause of it, or what happens to the brain that causes somebody to believe that they don't exist?
So I think that the first caveat we need here is that there are very few brain imaging studies of patients with Cotards. It's very hard to get them in a scanner when they are suffering so much. But saying that, in the last couple of years, there have been two or three cases that have turned up some evidence as to what's happening in the brain. And what seems to be happening is that there is a network in the brain that's responsible for internal awareness, awareness of our own body, awareness of our emotions, awareness of our, self-related thoughts. And in Cotards, it seems like that particular network is damped down. In some sense, their own experience of their body in all its vividness and in experience of their own emotions in all its vividness, that's compromised very severely. So in some sense, they're not feeling themselves vividly. It's as simple as that. But then there's also something else that is happening in the brain. It seems like parts of the brain that are responsible for rational thought are also damaged. So first of all, what might be happening is a perception that arises in their brain saying that they're dead because they're not literally perceiving their own body and body states and emotions vividly. And then that perception, irrational though it is not being shot down because other parts of the brain that would have been able to rationalize and say, okay, no, this is silly, they're unable to do that either.
But this means, doesn't it, that there's like a part of the brain that is responsible for us comprehending that we exist?
Yeah, and existence could simply be, at some level, the vividness of our experience. So maybe we just equate existence to feeling our emotions, feeling our body, feeling the environment in all its vividness. And when that vividness for some reason goes away, then the brain just this is at some level a bit of speculation, but maybe that's what the brain is doing, that, oh, it's not vivid anymore. It must be because, one doesn't exist. And so in some sense, existence is, being able to really relate to the body, to the environment, to all the senses really sharply.
There's another disorder you write about called body integrity identity disorder. And this is when you don't believe that a part of your body is really yours. Like you believe that, for instance, a leg might be alien, or that an arm really isn't an actual part of your body. And sometimes people with that condition actually want the limb in question to be amputated. Some people try to amputate it themselves. Some people beg doctors to amputate it for them. How else would you describe this disorder?
I think you've described it well. It really is a very disturbing condition in the sense that, it's not something you would normally ever experience. If I look at my hand or if you look at your hand, there is no doubt in your mind that that is your hand. Now imagine if you looked at your hand and it didn't feel like yours, and it didn't feel like yours for 20, 30 years. It could be a very debilitating thing, and that it seems to be like that for people experiencing or suffering from BIID. And, they do take extreme measures. It's basically a mismatch between the internal perception they have of their own body and the physical body. And what's intriguing and interesting in terms of the self is that what is most important for our sense of self, our bodily self, is the internal perception of it. You can look at your body and you can see your hand or leg that is fully functional, and yet if it doesn't feel like yours, the feeling is the much more important part of one's self, not the fact that you can see it and you can function with this leg.
You met a patient who wanted to have one of his limbs amputated. It was his leg, I believe.
Yes, it was his leg.
And so you talked to him before the operation and you talked to him immediately after the operation. Would you tell us about those conversations?
Yeah, I think, I talked to him a few times before the operation, trying to find out, what it was really that he was suffering from. And he really felt like this leg, part of his leg, was not his. It was, it was really something he didn't want. He would try a whole range of things to make it seem as if he didn't have it. He would fold his leg and pretend it wasn't there. He would push it to one side. I mean, it really seemed to ruin his life. And I remember asking him once, so what does it exactly feel like? And he says, it feels like my soul doesn't extend into that part of my leg. And that's the kind of language that most people who say they are suffering from BIID would kind of use. They really feel like that body part is not theirs. And, in one way to kind of understand what might be happening in BIID is actually to look at the converse problem. Most people by now will be really well aware of this phenomenon called phantom limbs. When you actually have an amputation, say, because of some unfortunate accident or infection, and you lose an arm or a leg, many people continue to feel that the limb still exists. And some people even feel pain in that imaginary limb. And what that's telling you is that what you're perceiving as your limb is actually some representation of the limb in your brain, not the physical limb, because after an amputation, the physical limb is actually gone, but you're still perceiving it.
So when you visited the patient who had part of his leg removed, and you visited him after the amputation, he didn't have any regrets.
No, that was the amazing thing. I saw him within about 12 hours after his amputation, and I remember talking to the doctor, who said, "You'll be surprised. Normally, this doctor was an orthopedic surgeon, and he does routine amputations for people who have had accidents or who need amputations in the regular course of their treatment, and most people who lose a limb because of some injury, they are very depressed after such amputations." And the doctor said that you'll be surprised at how different a BIID patient will be after having a leg or arm amputated. And that was indeed the case. I mean, within 12 hours, this patient that I saw, he was sitting up, and in, you know, there was no regret. I mean, he really seemed fine with having given up his leg.
So the man who we've been discussing, who had part of his leg amputated because he just didn't believe that it was his, he thought it was alien, and he just wanted to, he wanted it removed. Once he had it successfully removed, was he aware of its absence? Did he miss it? Did he notice that he couldn't walk the way he used to, that he needed crutches? You saw him right after the surgery, and mm-hmm. I don't know if he's gotten a prosthetic since then, which really wouldn't be part of his body. But you know, he needed crutches to walk. He knew that there'd been some kind of change, and that there was an absence, that he couldn't walk.
Right.
I mean,
So this is the paradox of that condition, is that people will say that they feel complete and whole after they have lost that limb that wasn't theirs. So they're well aware that they're going to be disabled. They don't have any doubts about that. In fact, they spend quite a lot of time before they actually do the amputation pretending to not have a limb. They will crutch before they actually get the surgery. They will tie up their leg so that it feels like a stump and walk around and practice. And so it's very much an issue of something inside them saying that their body should not have this limb, and the mismatch that they can see between having a limb that is not theirs and the way they feel about themselves internally. Once that limb is gone, somehow they feel complete. And it's really something that people who don't suffer from it will find very hard to understand, as do I. I mean, I cannot fathom what that must be like, and we have to take their word for how it feels within themselves.
So what are the ethical questions now surrounding whether a doctor who's treating somebody who believes that a leg or an arm isn't really theirs and they want to have it fully or partially amputated?
I think there are serious ethical questions. The doctor that I talked to who did this particular amputation is convinced that the people that he treats are suffering. They are suffering psychologically, and he thinks it's his duty to relieve them of their suffering. Now, you can also talk to doctors who believe completely who see it the other way around, that here's someone with a perfectly healthy limb, functional limb, and that they would be harming them by doing the amputation. So the debate is ongoing. It's not at all resolved. BIID is not a medically recognized condition, so research is, funding is difficult to get. So until people actually sort out, what the neurological underpinnings, if that's the case, are, and what the subjective experiences of these people are, and how much of that is, so to say, in the mind versus something real. All of these things are to be thrashed out, and until that happens, you're going to have these sort of situations where people will take matters into their own hand.
So what does body integrity identity disorder tell us about how the brain and body create a sense of self?
So I think what this is telling us really is about the bodily self, the idea that when you close your eyes and you have a sense of your own body, you don't have to see it, you have a sense of the body. And what BIID is telling us is that the sense that we have of our own body is actually, we are perceiving the information in the brain, and if everything is working well, that information, those maps in the brain that the brain has created of the body, they will match the physical body. And so in reality, you are perceiving your physical body. But in situations where there's a mismatch, so for some reason the map in the brain for a certain part of your limb hasn't quite developed the way it should, but your physical limb has actually developed properly, and that mismatch leads you to perceiving your bodily self in a very different way. So this is telling you that that the brain is actually constructing the sense of the bodily self you know, moment by moment. And you can do experiments in labs where you can disrupt this sense of bodily self. You can, for instance, there's a very famous experiment called the rubber hand illusion, where you can make a person take ownership of a rubber hand instead of their real hand. And so it's telling you that this process, it's a process in the brain, and it's happening moment by moment, and it's very malleable, and it doesn't always correspond to reality. And the other thing that, you know, BID and conditions like this tell us is that the self, the perceiving self, the thing that is experiencing all this is somehow more fundamental than something like body ownership. So you can experience being someone who owns all the body parts, or you can be someone who has a feeling that, oh, this part of my body is not mine. So there is something behind, in some sense, that is the experiencing entity that is able to experience both either ownership of a body part or a lack of ownership of body part. So it raises questions about who or what that entity is, who or what is that I that says, I don't own this leg or I own this leg. So it just pushes that question further and further.
My guest is Anil Ananthaswamy, author of the new book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. We'll talk about Alzheimer's disease and what that tells us about the sense of self after we take a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Roadie, the first neighbor-to-neighbor shipping community. Roadie connects people who need to send stuff with drivers heading in the right direction. Whether you need to send a table cross-country or pick up concert tickets across town, Roadie gets your stuff delivered faster, easier, and friendlier. To send something, download the free Roadie app on your Apple or Android device. And for some good karma, donate any items to a local charity, and Roadie will deliver them for free now until August 3rd. Just enter code GOODKARMA in the Roadie app to get started.
You mentioned the rubber hand illusion, and you actually participated in this. Just describe what you experienced, like what this experiment is and what you experienced.
So the rubber hand illusion is actually a very simple experiment. It's something you can do at home. Just, you know, go onto Amazon, order a rubber hand, which, you know, you can for $5. And what you have to then do is sit on a table, put your, say, your left hand on the table, put the rubber hand nearer you, put a screen between the rubber hand and the real hand so that you can't see your real hand, and then have someone stroke with two paintbrushes both the rubber hand and the real hand simultaneously in exactly the same speed at exactly the same spots on your fingers. The caveat here is you have to be watching the rubber hand. So now what's happening is you're getting two sensations. One sensation is the sensation of touch that the paintbrush is making on your real hand, and the other sensation is the visual one. You're watching the rubber hand being stroked. And it's amazing. For most people, about two-thirds of the people who undergo this experiment, within about 2 minutes, they will start feeling the touch at the location of the rubber hand instead of on the real hand. And it's a very, very shocking feeling to experience, because suddenly it's just something you can't comprehend rationally, but you can't stop it. You know the rubber hand is a rubber hand. You know your real hand is being touched with a brush. All of that cognitive knowledge doesn't help. Your brain will take ownership of the rubber hand, and it'll make it feel like it's yours.
So what did that tell you, and what does that tell neuroscientists?
So again, it's telling us that when it comes to constructing a sense of the body, the brain has to integrate a whole range of sensations. So in this case, we were talking of vision and touch, but actually there's a whole lot of other things that the brain is trying to put together. There's proprioception, which is the sense you have of your body in three-dimensional space. There is vestibular sensations, which gives you your sense of balance. There's touch, vision, sound, all of the sensations that are coming from either outside or from within the body. The brain has to integrate all this to create your sense of being a body. And if everything is working correctly, then this, what they call multi-sensory integration, creates your bodily self. Now, you can mess with that. And all it's, what it's telling you is that what you perceive is really a whole bunch of information processing that is going on in the brain moment by moment, and you can disrupt it.
let's take a look at Alzheimer's disease. Now, this is a very common condition now in which people slowly get erased in a way, in the sense that their memories are erased. Their sense of who they are, who they've been, is erased. How does that relate to the question you're asking about how we construct a sense of self, how our brain and body construct it?
So Alzheimer's disease, as you say, unfortunately, literally erases a very important part of our sense of self, which is the narrative that we have in our heads about who we are. And this narrative is something that the brain constructs, and we're not even aware that it's actually a constructed thing. When we just think of ourselves, we have this expansive narrative inside us about who we are. And what Alzheimer's unfortunately does is it, A, puts a stop to the narrative forming. So because short-term memory formation is impaired, it becomes harder and harder for a person with Alzheimer's to start having new memories. And once you stop having or forming new memories, these memories don't get incorporated into your narrative. So in some sense, your narrative stops forming. And as the disease progresses, it starts eating away at the existing narrative. It starts basically destroying a whole range of memories that go towards constituting the person that you are. But in terms of, talking about the self, what this is telling you is that the self is multi-layered, that there's a narrative component to it. And what Alzheimer seems to be doing is destroying the narrative component to the point that, the person really cannot recognize anyone. We don't know when a person with Alzheimer's is at the end stage of the disease. We have no way of communicating with them. So when you hear language about, there is no one in there, or there's no self in there, or this person has completely lost himself or herself, that's language that's coming from caregivers, from people who are looking at the person from the outside and inferring the loss of a self. Now, we really don't know what the situation is from the perspective of the person suffering from Alzheimer's, especially late-stage Alzheimer's.
Let me switch to ecstatic experiences and what they have to tell us about the sense of self. And you write about ecstatic epilepsy, and this is a certain type of epileptic seizure, which I'd like you to describe.
So ecstatic epilepsy or ecstatic seizures are what are called focal seizures. So they are happening in a small part of the brain. They don't knock you unconscious, unlike grand mal seizures, which would overwhelm the cortex and you would lose consciousness. Ecstatic seizures, as the name suggests, are seizures that make the person who's experiencing the seizure ecstatic. They, if you listen to them describe their experiences, they talk about feeling joy, bliss, a feeling of well-being, physical and mental well-being. Their sense of time slows down. They have a sense of certitude about everything around them. One of the persons I talked to who had these seizures would talk about how he would look at everything around him, and it would seem like everything was in place the way it should be, as if there was a divine force behind it. And also the other thing that happens is there's a very heightened sense of your own body and your sensations and your environment. So, there's a strange paradox that happens here where they're saying that they feel their bodily self, their environment very intensely, and yet something about the boundary between themselves and the outside world disappears, where they feel like they're one with something larger, with the universe. So as I'm describing this, it'll probably, to many listeners, it'll be very obvious that we might be talking about mystical experiences. And it does have mystical overtones, the slowing down of time, the vividness of, your perceptions, the sense of certitude, the sense that there is some divinity behind, what you're perceiving. All these things are exactly what's happening in ecstatic epilepsy.
Have you ever experienced extremes of consciousness? Intentionally or unintentionally?
Unfortunately, no.
You say unfortunately.
I would have liked to, just to know what it's like. But no, it's my understanding of a lot of this is intellectual, and it would be something to be able to experience. I have meditated, but not with the necessary intensity or not for enough of a length of time to have come to a point where I can appreciate what these things might mean.
Have you experienced extreme self-consciousness, the kind of self-consciousness where you're almost narrating everything that you are doing and thinking and feel like you almost exist outside of your body and that you're, you know, you're a character in your own story?
That can happen sometimes, yes. Extreme self-consciousness, I agree. And but again, not too much. I'm fairly...
Well-balanced?
I didn't want to say that.
moderate?
I think, no, I haven't really experienced extremes of that either. But I've experienced probably more of self-consciousness, you know, self-consciousness in a social setting, self-consciousness in terms of being so hyper-aware of your own thoughts and stories and narratives that it can actually become a little too much. Yes, I have experienced that rather than, you know, say an ecstatic state of consciousness or some other kind of dissociation.
You have a cousin who died of a brain tumor not long ago, and he had the kind of dissociative experience as a result of his brain tumor, the kind of experience that you describe in your book. And do you want to describe the experience that he had?
Yeah, he passed away. He was just in his 30s. He had a brain tumor, and he was driving to work one day when he pulled over. This was in New Delhi. He pulled over and called his mom to tell her that he was seeing another himself. I mean, there was a duplicate who was in front of him, and that this duplicate was also experiencing emotions. This duplicate was sad about the life that had passed, and so my cousin really, actually it's my cousin's son. So my cousin's son, really got frightened because, you know, it's very rarely would anyone experience having another you in front of you with whom you're having some sort of interaction. And this in literature, this is called a doppelganger effect, and it's actually pretty well explained.
What did his neurologist have to say about it?
I think his neurologist just attributed it to, you know, seizures, and, you know, because he was having seizures because of his condition. So they just increased the medication, and they didn't do anything more about it. And it didn't recur that many times. I think it might have happened one or two more times, but sadly he passed away not long after that.
Were you already writing your book when he had that experience?
Yeah, I didn't know about his experience. I had already begun writing my book, and I was actually, I had gone to meet my cousin after her son had passed away. And that's when she told me about this. And at that point, I said, oh, you know, this is something I'm writing about. Will you be willing to talk about it? And she agreed.
So you live part of the time in Berkeley, California, and the other part of the time in Bangalore, India. You grew up in India, but not in Bangalore. What are some of the biggest cultural conflicts going back and forth between those two places?
The way my sense of self feels, interestingly, because India is a much, much more crowded place, for one. I mean, you know, your sense of your private space is very different, and it's a much less individualistic society in some sense. You know, people are very much a part of your life, whether you like it or not. And so the way you perceive your own self, which in this context would be your cultural, social self, along with your private, you know, private self, bodily self, narrative, all of those things, those shift in very interesting ways as I move back and forth. I tend to feel my boundaries, my psychological boundaries, a little more intensely when I'm in the US, and a little less so when I'm in India. I'm definitely a product of both places now, because I grew up in India, but my adult life has been spent in the US. But I can definitely see and feel the transition to my own sense of self as I move back and forth.
You had been a software engineer before becoming a science journalist. Why did you change? And what was being a software engineer not giving you that you wanted?
I was not satisfied in some really visceral sense with software. I mean, I enjoyed the technical challenge of writing software. I was in a very nice small company here in Berkeley doing that. But at the end of the day, I did not find meaning in it somehow. And writing was pulling me. I really felt like I wanted to write in order to pay attention to the world. I kept feeling like existence is slipping away and I can't make sense of it. And software was definitely not helping me make sense of it. So I chose writing. I mean, I always liked writing. I hadn't done too much of it. But as I made the transition, I realized that writing for me is really my way of paying attention to the world, because I live too much in my head otherwise, and I tend to just walk around without paying attention. And by forcing myself to write about things, I'm simultaneously forcing myself to pay attention to things. And so far, it's working.
How has it changed you as a person to be paying attention like that and to be investigating the really big questions of outer space and inner space?
I think it's made me a quieter person in some sense. I think it grounds me in ways that something like software would never have. I just feel that paying it, when I think of what meditation is, for instance, in some very basic sense, it's about paying attention. And writing to me is doing that. It's by paying attention to whatever is happening within me, outside of me, to the broader culture, because you're writing about things that are happening in the culture. You're really just participating in the world in a much more visceral way than if I were not doing that. I mean, this is very specific to me, of course. I mean, given there are people who pay attention and who live these wonderful lives without writing about it, I was never capable of that. So writing has actually forced me to do that.
Well, I want to thank you for your writing, and thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much.
Anil Ananthaswamy is the author of the new book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. Here's another podcast you might want to check out, Alt Latino. It's a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. You'll hear from the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order. Alt Latino is from NPR Music. You can find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. For a bluesman who didn't come from one of the usual places and who didn't sound much like any of the Chicago bluesmen of the early 1950s, Slim Harpo not only had great success, but great influence, even though he was a late bloomer. With the release of his complete recordings by Bear Family Records, rock historian Ed Ward at last gets to tell his story.
By 1966, I discovered British rock groups and Electric American Blues, which I thought was dead or dying. Imagine my surprise, then, to turn on the car radio set to an AM Top 40 station and hear blues.
Oh, I'm itching, and I don't know where to scratch. Come here, baby. Scratching my back. I know you can do it, so baby, get to it. Ah, you're working with it now.
Baby Scratch My Back was the number one hit on the black music charts in early 1966 and even got as high as 16 on the mainstream pop charts. It was an engaging record, all right, but who was this guy and where did he come from? Some of that is pretty easily answered. James Moore was born in 1924 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and lived there his entire life. Unlike New Orleans, Baton Rouge had a bunch of down-home, guitar-playing bluesmen, and Moore, with his distinct declarative harmonica style, could fit in with a lot of them. He spent a little time in New Orleans working on the docks, but soon returned to Baton Rouge to set up as a contractor and play the clubs at night. Sometime between 1948 and 1951, he had the great good fortune to meet and marry Lavelle Jones, who worked in a sandwich shop in Baton Rouge. She had two kids from a previous marriage and developed into a competent businesswoman and a no-nonsense road manager for her husband. Playing in the clubs, Moore met a guy named Otis Hicks, a guitar player who called himself Lightnin' Slim. When he started making records for Feature Records in Crowley, Louisiana, he brought Moore, who he called Harmonica Slim, along with him. Feature was run by J.D. Miller, who began recording Cajun music in the late 1940s and, with the coming of rock and roll, diversified into blues. Lightnin' Slim was one of his first signings, and it was during a 1957 session of his that Slim Harpo was born. Afraid that his harp man would quit if Miller didn't record him, he handed Moore a song to do. Miller hated it. The song was great, but Moore's way of singing it sounded all wrong. Then he had an inspiration. "James," he said, "I want you to sing, but sing it nasal." Moore thought he was nuts, but he tried it. Turned out it wasn't such a crazy idea after all.
Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. Well, I can make honey, baby, let me come inside. I'm young and able.
And the other side had another classic.
God love that you want it, baby. God love that you want it, baby. Got a love that you want it. Got your love that you want it. Got a love that you want it. We can rock on wild. We can rock on wild.
Miller's approach to the record business was to release country and Cajun records locally and find larger labels to release his blues recordings. His best relationship was with Excello, a Nashville label that promoted itself through Ernie's Record Mart, a mail-order business that bought time on WLAC, Nashville's Clear Channel radio station. Even so, Slim Harpo wasn't an overnight success, and it wasn't until 1961 that he had his first national hit.
Raining in my heart since we've been apart. I know I was wrong. Baby, please come home. You got me crying.
Rainin' in My Heart got to 17 on the R&B chart and even did well on the pop charts. Meanwhile, Miller and Excello could be sure of at least some strong regional success with Slim Harpo Records, and Moore could use them to tour the South and make money doing construction work at home in Baton Rouge between records. By the time Baby Scratch My Back hit in 1966, the British bands had discovered Slim Harpo. The Rolling Stones put King Bee on their first album, although Mick Jagger famously told Rolling Stone, "What's the point in listening to us do I'm a King Bee when you can listen to Slim Harpo doing it?" Keith Richards said that one of his favorite songs was by Slim Harpo, a very telling one indeed.
Lord, I wonder what done happened. Ain't nobody here but me. All these empty bottles on the table, yeah. I knew I didn't drink all this by myself. I must have had a blues hangover. What's this? My check. And I don't have change for a grasshopper, and that's too crooked.
The Stones weren't the only Slim Harpo fans in England. The Kinks, the Yardbirds, the Pretty Things, Them, Love Sculpture, and Pink Floyd all recorded his tunes, and the Moody Blues took their name from one of his more obscure instrumentals. Slim Harpo's success came when the rock scene in America was also beginning to look to electric blues, and the Paul Butterfield Band and others were sharing stages with Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, and Magic Sam. it would just be a matter of time until he started getting invited to share stages with rock bands, and his wife Lavelle was always there helping to make sure things went right. And he was getting more inventive with his backup, too.
I want you to be my Tina Nina. I want you to be my Tina Nina. Tell me the truth. Ain't you my Tina Nina? Now, will you love me?
By 1967, he was recording with the same Memphis band that would soon back Al Green, with Mabon Teenie Hodges on guitar. Excello figured you couldn't sell a blues man to white audiences without having a guitar in the picture, but the guitars on the album covers are props. In January 1970, he and Lavelle got passports. They were on their way to England. In the middle of the night of January 31st, though, he screamed, waking Lavelle, who discovered he was dead. It was a heart attack. His second, as it turned out. He was 45 years old. But many of the musicians who played with him are still alive, and his music still gets played at Baton Rouge clubs and at the annual Baton Rouge Blues Festival.
Ed Ward lives in Austin. He played music from Buzzin' the Blues, the complete Slim Harpo box set on Bear Family Records. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, one of the best performances I saw in the past year was by a dog. Make that two dogs who share the leading role in the Hungarian drama White God. It's just come out on DVD, and tomorrow I'll talk with the woman who trained these dogs, Teresa Miller. She spent her career following in her father's footsteps, training animals for movies and TV. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.